Hi, I'm Katie Hill. Following years facing the fear on Blue Peter, 2 decades working on TV and radio, and years training and qualifying, I now work as a coach and speaker with Limitless, encouraging others to live all out. Because what's the point if you're not playing big? What's the point if you're not living your full potential? What if the one thing standing in your way is you? I'll be sharing my own tools and techniques from my coach training and life, plus inspiring interviews to help you live the life you were born to live. I'm Katie Hill, and this is the Limitless Podcast. Whether you know her as an author, actress, blogger, presenter, podcaster, or as the gorgeous human who kept everyone's spirits up and won the most recent I'm a Celebrity, you will know I had to get this wonderful human on. It gives me so much pleasure to say, welcome to the Limitless Podcast, Giovanna Fletcher. Good morning.
Morning. And you said my name right. Look at you. No, you know what? I'm just so used to everyone saying Giovanna now. I'm just a bit yeah. But you know, but it is actually really simple.
So simple.
People have just got so used to saying Giovanna.
The only way I know it is because I actually saw you do a thing saying it's Savannah. It's Giovanna, yeah. Savannah. Because it's like, I think even on I'm a Celebrity, they said it wrong. And I'm like, who is she? Like, how do you say it? No wonder call yourself G.
Well, exactly. And I heard that Ant and Dec got a lot of jip on the first couple of episodes for saying it wrong. And then my campmates were saying it right. And then they somehow slipped into Giovanna. And I'm just like, yeah, that's fine.
But it's funny because it seems like a small thing, but it's actually a big thing. Because it's like, for me, my name's spelt K-A-T-Y. Anyone I'm emailing who spells it with an I-E and continues to do that, even though I'm consistently signing, you know, it's kind of like, come on, people, wake up. But anyway, it is
a weird one. I think it's something that I've accepted all the way through my life. But the more I think it's being discussed now about people should be able to say people's names.
You know,
I think that's being discussed more and more. Yeah. So it is kind of making me go, actually, why have I accepted that so much?
Bless you. Honestly, I'm so excited to get you on because, you know, we all fell in love with you on I'm a Celebrity. You have so many hats that you wear. Which of all of them do you think feels like the main one, or is there a main one?
It's hard, isn't it? I would say it's a toss-up between author and the podcast.
Yeah.
But then the podcast was born out of writing, so, you know, one wouldn't exist without the other. So definitely writing. I'm currently writing the 12th book.
I read. Yeah. It's out later this year, right?
Later this year, So Walking on Sunshine, which is inspired a lot by the treks that I do for Copperfield. And it's the sixth novel. So it's the sixth fiction novel. And then I've had 2 novellas. And then I've written a couple with Tom and then a couple of nonfiction. But it feels so nice to get back to fiction because you just, especially I write first person. So I immerse myself in the characters. And this is a group of friends who all kind of find themselves in a time of life where they're thinking, is this it? You know, they've done the thing. They've met the love of their life. They've got engaged. They've had the kids all at different parts of that. And they've all found themselves going, well, is this it actually? Motherhood is far harder than I thought. One of the man in it, he's met the love of his life, but she sadly just passed away. And the one that's got engaged is suddenly going, well, hold on, I'm never going to have all those firsts again. So is this it in terms of all of that and all that excitement? So they're 3 friends and they decide to go on a trek together to kind of take themselves out of their funk and explore life a bit.
And I saw on Instagram you did the other day of you typing with 3 fingers. 3 fingers. I was like, this is amazing. You and my dad.
It was incredible. But it's so funny, isn't it? Because, I mean, I went to theatre school. We didn't have computers, to be honest with you. So, you know, I do feel like maybe we were slightly late when it comes to computers. And you get by. And it turns out I'm quite quick with 3 fingers.
You're very quick. It's super impressive. And I just think, this is your 12th book, like, that's amazing. What do you get out of writing, do you think?
Oh, I love it. It's almost therapeutic, cathartic, getting those thoughts down. And so I was acting before, I went to drama school. So I went to Silver Young Theatre School, and then I went to Rose Bruford to do an acting degree. And I did little bits coming out of it, but nothing, you know, the recession was hitting around the same time. The parts weren't filtering down. It was all, you know, they just weren't there. And I decided to try and use my creativity and get a bit of control.
Yeah.
So I started writing, and there was lots of rejection. There was, you know, lots of stuff going on, but I kept going. And it is that thing of when you sit down, I kind of feel like I write what I need, and I don't realise that I've needed it until I finish the book.
I love that.
I mean, it is stressful. It's stressful getting those words down and being on deadline and trying to get everything out. But that feeling of when it goes off to the editor, that is a gorgeous feeling. And then it feels like you've handed in the biggest essay of your life and you're waiting for your teacher to get back to you.
Yeah.
So that can be a bit stressful. But then when readers read it and they've connected to the characters or it's moved them in some way, that I absolutely love, to know that you've moved someone and you've made them feel a certain way. Tom is always my go-to on books. Oh. I make him read them and then I film his reactions.
That's amazing. But actually, just listening to you talk, it's so funny because in coaching, we always talk about somebody's why. And actually, often the why is the thing that gets you through. So I guess with you, with your writing, it's the impact you're going to have on the other side. It's that feeling you're going to have when you hand it over to the editor that keeps you going in those dark moments of endless coffee.
I used to let myself have a spoonful of Nutella at 4 o'clock in the day if I'd got to a certain amount. Oh. I don't do that anymore, but that was good.
In my family, we actually have a word for a spoonful of Nutella because we were on holiday years ago, and Trey and I, my husband, were in the cupboard with the Nutella spooning it mid-afternoon, as you speak of.
Yes,
and our toddler walked into the room, our Kaya, and we were so utterly horrified that she would think this was a thing because it wasn't a habit we wanted. We both looked at her really guiltily and Trey just went, "Scoop the roop." And he's like, "What the hell is that? What is scoop the roop?" And so So then it became like this forbidden fruit, scoop the root. And the kids knew scoop the root was a whole, and we're not talking a teaspoon either.
I love this. I think most parents have probably been found in the cupboard spooning Nutella.
There we
and
are.
I've had it and I've said, "Oh, it's spicy." Yeah. They did not buy that for a second.
That's amazing. My kids always said, "Oh, it's too spicy." Well, thank God they found a spooning Nutella and not any other kind of spooning. It could have been a whole lot worse.
That's very true.
I love that you have that habit though, and I love your relationship with Tom, because for me that is something that really shines through everything that you put out online and when you were in I'm a Celebrity. Just the kind of authentic connection that you guys have. And I had no idea that you met at Sylvia Young. So how old were you?
We were 13 when we first met.
Wow.
Yeah, and I sat down next to him on my first day, because we were sat in alphabetical order in year groups. And it's a small school, there's only 140 people at the time. And I sat down next to him and, you know, this grinning little pink-faced boy with blonde curtains. And he was like, "What's your name?" And I was like, "My name's Giovanna, but you can call me G." And he was like, "My name's Tom, but you can call me T." and I was like, "Okay." And it was just really sweet. And we went out. We actually started dating for a couple of days straight away. And then he dumped me for his ex-girlfriend. Oh. Yeah. And then we had years of drama of kind of like, I like you, I don't like you. You know, it was a small school, but, you know, he managed to work his way around it. and we spent lots of lunchtimes kind of snogging in corridors while we talked over our issues.
I love it. Issues. Teenage issues.
Teenage issues. Yeah. All the drama. Which is funny because you've got a 14-year-old. So,
yes.
You know, who's in their life right now? You just never know.
Oh, my gosh.
Who's going to stick around and who's going to impact their lives.
Proper love story.
Yeah. And we dated when we were 16 for a year. 15 for a year. So we split up when we were 16. And then my parents had got divorced. We lived on opposite ends of the M25. So around the opposite ways of the M25 is a circle, you know, the opposite ways. Yeah. And we just thought this will never work. And then once we started driving, it was a little bit different. And in fact, I went to Namibia for a month for a gap challenge. So I was away, and at that stage, it was you definitely didn't take mobile phones away because of the bill and everything. And in fact, totally. I think it was pay as you go. So there was no point. And so I had no way of contacting anyone. And I was dating someone else at that point. But while I was over there, all I was thinking about was Tom.
Oh.
And I didn't do anything when I got back. But I started Rose Bruford. And he was just so thrilled for me, even though McFly was starting and they're very early stages. I think they'd just moved into a house together. He was so excited that I was moving into my own place and sending me letters. And it was really cute. And I just decided one night on the drive over to my ex-boyfriend's that I was going to finish it. And Tom had offered me nothing but friendship. It wasn't like there was anything else in that. But I just thought, you know what, I'm not feeling that actually, because whereas Tom was really excited, this other guy wasn't really that bothered.
Oh, that's so interesting. Or actually potentially a bit jealous, maybe.
Well, who knows? I don't know.
So random.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and that's a long time ago now, that I'm 36 now, so 18 years ago.
So would you say, if you were thinking of like top three moments in your life that have shaped you, would meeting Tom be one of those?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess that kind of coincides as well with going to Sylvia's, because if I hadn't have gone to Sylvia's, then I wouldn't have met Tom.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, that was a big thing as a 13-year-old travelling into London every day.
Huge.
Because we lived in Ingatestone, a little village
in Essex. Oh my gosh, I know Ingatestone.
Oh, it's amazing.
I used to go to, what was that amazing bistro in Ingatestone called?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh no, really near it there was one. Oh, I can't remember. There's beautiful. I lived in Brentwood.
Oh, so, did you?
Yeah, very close. Just down the road.
Well, that's where I grew up. Well, I was there from when I was 9. We were in Barkingside before that. And I remember moving out to Ingatestone. And oh my gosh, just that feeling of being out in the country. I can remember walking to school on my own at 9.
Did you go to the Anglo-European?
We lived next door to the Anglo-European.
Oh, wow.
Literally the house next door.
Wow.
But I can remember walking to like junior school and stuff, and just seeing birds on the road, and them not moving out of your way, and just feeling like Mary Poppins. It was that thing of just moving somewhere that wasn't in the thick of it. It felt like countryside. It felt like we had space. So I loved it there. And then, when I was 12, I saw Sylvia on Live and Kicking. And I applied off the back. I literally, while she was on, the strap line was saying, you know, for more info, phone this number. So without my mum knowing.
You were like, quick, write it down, write it down.
Yeah, without my mum knowing, which you shouldn't do, because it always says, ask a bill payer's permission. I phoned the number and got a prospectus and then applied without my mum and dad knowing. And then the audition date came through. And I sort of said to my mum and dad, look, this is what we're doing. And they knew nothing of this world. Like, I did amateur dramatics. I loved that. But they knew nothing of this world. But they really supported me and went along. So, yes, definitely going to Sylvia's and meeting Tom. I think those two kind of, they're part of the same thing that has shaped my life, I would
absolutely.
Say.
Absolutely. And then probably the three other key men in your life.
Yes, my boys.
Amazing my boys. Names. Buzz, Buddy and Max. What happened to the third B?
Well, Max is Maxwell. Tom's nan's on her side, Maxwell, I think it's a surname that was sort of carried through, and we knew that it would mean a lot to her to have that honoured in some way. So we decided on Max. Max Mario, so my dad's in there as well. Names is a funny thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so weird. When we actually called our son, so our daughter's Kaya Sky, and our son is called Akira 7, but he was actually called 7 for the first 4 days of his life.
Really?
And everyone that came into the room, they were like, what's your baby's name? And I was like, 7. And they were like, no, what's his name? Okay, I cannot give a child a lifetime of that if he wants it when he's older. So Akira's still a bit out there, but children's names though is just incredible. But I think we'll get onto the whole, you know, how you guys have handled the pandemic, but just to sort of speak into something you said just now, I think what's amazing with you is it would have been very easy going through the Sylvia Young system of, you know, dramatics to be so zoned in on theatre and acting and film and whatever, that actually when the work wasn't there during the recession that you talked about, the pivot that you would have done and the resilience you would have shown to start writing, that would have been huge for you.
Mm, I went through a phase. So I did a play called Backbeat up in Scotland and it was incredible. Again, just kind of taking yourself out of your normal life and putting you somewhere else. And we were there for 6 weeks. It was amazing. And then when I came back, I was just so bored of waiting for my phone to ring and having an agent who, you know, I've got a lot of love for him, but we got to a point where there wasn't really much that he was doing for me. It wasn't working. And I was just, you know, that thing of when you're phoning your agent and your phone calls aren't going past the assistant, it's kind of something's not quite right.
Yeah.
And it's that, and I just kind of felt like I've got to do something. It's funny because I think of that first book and writing it, and I'm always very aware of how I wash over it, I kind of go, yeah, then I wrote a book, but actually
so casual,
dedicate so much time to something that you've got no guarantee at the end of it. You don't know what's going to come of it. And to be honest, before I got to that point, I think I went on lots and lots and lots of walks, being out in nature and, you know, just seeing animals around and, even seeing a road cut through countryside is sometimes the most beautiful thing.
Yeah.
So that to be honest really helped get me out of that headspace and kind of let me realign what I should be doing and where to put that focus. Mm. And at the time when I started writing, I wasn't closing the door in acting, and I don't think I ever will close the door on that. It's just that I was able to find something else that I loved, because, you know, I did all the jobs on bars and chaperoning like little kids in theatre and TV and stuff. And I worked in different shops and, you know, all of that stuff. But I just thought, if I can find something else that I love, that feeds me in the same way, that might not be acting, but I can use the skills that I have. Because for a long time, I mean, I've always been a massive reader. I've loved reading. You know, it's definitely a hobby. I'm one of those annoying people that can be on an escalator and my head's be in a book as I'm shuffling around. But, you know,
get out of my way.
Yeah, exactly. What are you doing? I've got work to go to. You know, I've always been that person. But I think in terms of writing a book, I always thought that was someone who went to Oxford or Cambridge to study English. Those people become
that's
authors.
The stuff we tell ourselves, isn't it? To talk ourselves out of doing things. We make excuses as to why we can't.
Exactly. Not someone who went to drama school and played make-believe for 3 years.
Yeah.
But then I started breaking it down and kind of going, well, actually, it's all storytelling, isn't it?
That is the
and
person
that is
who
what
does
I
it.
Think. Yeah. And that is what I think is the link through everything that I do. It's the storytelling aspect. You write something, you make a podcast, you do that because you want that person on the other end to be moved, to feel comforted, to, you know, whatever that is that you want that person to feel. And and I think that is definitely a through line through all of it.
Mm.
But yeah, starting to write.
Yeah. And I think there was probably an element of, and it's quite a similarity with the characters in your new book, is an element of taking the power back, because it's in those moments that you feel lost and a bit powerless, and how incredible it is to find something new and go, oh my gosh, this is a new angle that I'm coming at. This is how exciting. Yeah.
And there is always that thing as well, when you start writing, for anyone who, there's so many people who kind of go, oh, I'd love to write a book. But when you actually start writing, you don't know whether you're going to like it or not. You don't know whether it's for you, but it's something that you've got to apply yourself to, and you just got to go for it. And I absolutely love getting lost in those characters and being taken away somewhere new. You know, it is that thing where, you know, there are pressures, but it's blooming wonderful just to sit in those worlds and to take that control back, because I always feel like I had the control until I send it off to my editor. And even though I feel a relief, the relief is amazing, that relief of sending off, I feel like I am literally about 10 stone lighter.
So have they seen nothing of it at this point, or they've seen a synopsis at the start, but have they seen chapters as you go?
So sometimes each book differs depending on my deadline and how busy I am. Basically, it's changed every book. But in an ideal world, they wouldn't see it until the end. Other times they might not. They might get half of it and then another half. So that's how I usually do it, I would say now. Just so that basically I get to halfway through and I just upload it to go, yep, great. That's it. That's, you won't give me any more than that. That's it.
Oh, wow.
But it's enough to kind of carry on.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so I feel so much lighter when that goes in.
Yeah.
It's a gorgeous feeling. But and then that control is kind of taken away a little bit because you're waiting for someone else's thoughts. But I think that's an amazing thing about writing, about podcasts. I've found something that I have ownership on,
yes,
and that I have the control on, because I think that's the thing with acting. It's all taken out of your hands so much. So much of what we do is taken out of our hands in terms of TV and things. And I just think it's, for me, my base will always be in the work that I create, because that is where I get to put the most heart.
And the storytelling that runs through. So how did the podcast come about? Happy Mum, Happy Baby. Amazing title. And when I was watching you on I'm a Celebrity, I nearly fell off my chair with the 7 million downloads. It's probably
well,
more
we've
now.
We've had 12 million.
Oh, hello.
Because when we were recording that bit, I was like, no, we've just celebrated 12 million. And they were like, the lock's not going to open because we've somewhere online it says 7. And I was like, all right, say 7. But yeah. Yes, the podcast started because I was already writing fiction and I was on tour, on a book tour. I can't remember which one. And I'd already had two of the boys, I think. And quite a few people were saying, would you ever write a book about being a mum? And I just thought, oh, there's so many books out there that are so conflicting. You know, you've got your Gina Ford telling you how to
oh
do
my
one
gosh,
way and all these
even.
Things.
Yeah.
And I'd read all the books before having a baby and they made me feel like I knew nothing. Like, so when the baby came along, I thought, I just don't know how to implement all the words that I've written into this. And it turns out that ignoring the whole thing is much better for you and your baby. So I just thought, you know what, if I'm going to add to that, I'm going to just talk honestly about my experience. And so that became Happy Mum, Happy Baby. And being on the book tour for that, meeting other mums, you know, having those emotional encounters.
I bet you cried on quite a regular basis. Like, I
cried
can't imagine.
So much.
Yeah.
And it's that thing. So on book tours, we have events in the evenings where, you know, we sit down and it's kind of like a little interview. And I always feel like I turn into a bit of a stand-up comic in those situations. It's the theatre girl in me. What can
Love
I say?
It.
But it's that thing of being in a room and when you share something, there's laughter or there's and you feel that is understood completely by everyone in that room. And it's so powerful. And I just thought, I don't want those conversations that are so important to end, because we all know that there are certain things, whether it's a TV show, a book, music, something, sometimes they have their moment and then they go.
Yeah.
And motherhood, there are always new people coming into motherhood.
Yeah.
And they need that hand. They need that hand in the dark. They need to be told that they're not on their own, that whatever they're experiencing is valid and important. I think a couple of years ago, it was revealed that the leading cause of death in new mums is suicide.
Oh, my
God. And for me...
And I can, imagine we've all been there.
Yeah,
Like, I remember after my second being so low, I remember with my... And I'm one of the happiest people on the planet, and that freaked me out. And with my first, I remember I'd been so ingrained that breast was best. Yeah. And I remember breastfeeding my daughter and sobbing, and the tears were hitting her cheek.
Yeah.
And the midwife was so cute. I'd had every expert in to check my latch. I'd spent a fortune. And this wonderful midwife came in, and it made me think of her because of your title. Mm. And she's like, you need to start bottle feeding. And I was like, I can't. Literally couldn't speak. And she was like, happy mum, happy baby. You have to be happy. And if you're not, it's going to filter down. And it was... I literally sobbed with relief because somebody had given me permission to stop trying to do something that wasn't working for me.
Yeah. But, and it's so powerful. It's so powerful to have the other person do that. And I think we've got to think about the way that we use words and use them to build each other up. And when we share honestly, I feel like I feel like hearing someone else say what you have felt but never been able to vocalise, what you've carried as a burden that you feel ashamed for even thinking, having someone else vocalise that is such a relief.
Yeah.
It's such a relief to kind of go, it's not just me.
It is.
Motherhood is difficult. It's messy. Yeah. It's raw. And you, all those feelings, they come, they go. But understanding them and know, even simple things for me, like I can remember following someone and her making a little spoof about, or just talking about putting shoes on and how frustrating that can be in the morning and all the tears and the tantrums and how ridiculous it is. The next time I was having a, like, not me having a tantrum putting shoes on, yeah, but the kids were having a tantrum putting shoes on, I laughed. Because I just suddenly felt like it's not just me. I'm not on my own. We're
and
all
I
in
think
this together.
I love as well the fact that how social media has so changed the landscape on this thing. And you're always so genuine on social media. And I think, you know, my kids were born 2006 and 2009 and there was no social media. No. And that was actually why I at the time started a parenting blog, because there were people in the public eye who were in the papers, perfectly coiffed, doing a school run with a baby. And I looked at that and I thought, you are doing every new mum a disservice, because what you're not saying is that the nannies that you've got, the help that you've got, that they wouldn't have. And so they're going to look at that and think. And so that actually was the trigger for me starting my blog right back then. You know, and that was the only way that, like social media now, that you could get through. And I, you know, love that you've now got the podcast and all of it.
Well, it's so hard, isn't it? Because you think about the places where you do get to talk about things, whether it's whether it's on the sofa or something or on the radio, and you get such a short amount of time.
Yes.
So I do feel like for a lot of women and dads, you know, when they're asked about parenthood, you get such a short window. You can't explain yourself in any way. So all you get is, it's amazing. Best thing I've ever done. That's it.
Completely. I did.
And then
have
so anyone listening kind of goes,
I remember after my first, I literally remember going in the shower in the hospital and looking down and seeing the folds of skin and fat. And I was like, why did nobody tell me I'd have a leather handbag strapped to my front? So your three beauties, I mean, we're now recording, this is April 21. So we've just come back off the back of a pretty, what we could describe as, challenging year. How was it in your house?
Oh gosh, I mean, highs and lows.
Yeah,
I've got to say, I think for me, one of my things in terms of homeschooling, what I've discovered is that I grew up being such a teacher's pet. I aim to please. I like to get everything right. And for me, knowing that my kids didn't need to get everything right, that it was their learning, not mine, that them getting things wrong was just as beneficial for their teacher to see as them getting it right.
Yes.
I think that was a huge learning curve for me.
Yes.
And plus, the first lockdown, we only had one child who was doing homeschooling, because Buzz was in year one then. But then by this last lockdown, we had Buzz in year two and Buddy in reception. So we had two of them doing homeschooling and then Max going running around being wild. So that was challenging. So we tried to set them up a little area. But I would say when it started, it felt like quite the novelty. You know, it felt like the world had stopped.
Yeah. And it was a heat wave, wasn't it? Like this time last April, it was like, this is great. We make a veg patch, all the things.
Yes. And you just kind of embraced it because you're like, this is a pandemic and we're never going to have it again and we're never going to have this time. You know, the traffic outside stopped, you know.
Oh,
we
my
were
gosh.
Walking on the road. And
yes. Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
And then I think this third lockdown seemed a lot more difficult. First of all, it was winter. We're all inside a lot more.
Proper
we're
hardcore.
On top of each other a lot more. But then there's also this feeling of you've stopped, but somehow life outside is continuing. And those pressures are suddenly starting to build that weren't there before. So you suddenly start feeling actually, although this is something that we're all experiencing, we're not all experiencing the same things. And that is so important for people to realise as well. I think for so long, in the first lockdown, people were like, oh, we're all going through the same thing. And actually, we're not. Our experiences of it are so different. You know, we're so lucky to have a garden, to be able to put food on the table, to not worry about our job. You know, we're freelancers and we have contracts and it's all for everything's still going.
Yeah.
You know, and you do, I think it opens your eyes actually to the to things being different for everyone and how and how we've got to respect that. You know,
I love that saying that came out during it, that we're in the same storm but in different boats. You know,
yes.
Some people were in super yachts, some people had a dinghy with one paddle and they're trying to keep going, some people had a Lilo. And I mean, just no unified experience aside from walking through something massive. What do you think as a family, is there anything that you actually realized in lockdown that you loved that you're actually going to maintain going forward?
Oh, we love going for our walks. We love it. And what was interesting is, so when we started, Max was continuously either in the backpack or being carried. And now, you know, he just trots along with his brothers, and it's amazing to see that, you know, that growth. But just how brilliant it is for the boys to be out and about and I think that's been needed. You know, when you're all on top of each other and life just seems monotonous, getting outside, there's always something new happening in nature. You know, there's always sticks to be found, or snails to be on, slugs or worms. The amount of walks that I've been on with a bucket and come back with a, you know, trying to keep all the worms inside. It's
so true. So true. And it's funny because like that first and second lockdown were completely fine. But as you say, with the third one being in winter, my poor kids, I was so adamant that every day we were doing a walk. And so whatever the weather, we were out going, come on. I mean, I became that mother. And I remember one time we were walking across this field and we almost couldn't speak because of the wind chilling our faces. And I was like, this is great. Come on, team. We can do this.
Amazing. I just took hot chocolate in a flask and a can of squirty cream. So if it got really bad,
amazing.
I was like, squirty
cream straight in the mouth, I'd be with the squirty cream during that walk. So obviously during the pandemic, you got quite a special phone call to ask you to go to quite a special castle for ITV just before Christmas. Tell me about that whole process.
Oh, it was unbelievable. I was actually filming for Steph's Packed Lunch at the time.
Oh.
And it was the day that the Strictly lineup had been revealed. And I was talking to the producer there, and they were like,
"So were you up for that as well?"
No.
Okay.
But they were just saying, you know, the producer there, producer of Steph's Packed Lunch, was saying, "Oh, would you ever do Strictly?" And I was like, "No, you know, I've got two left feet. Even though I went to drama school, I feel like dancing was never my strong point. I left with basic understanding and an all-round effort, but never actually."
You know, you've done
anything.
It now. If anyone hears that, they're like, "Perfect, that's who we want."
And then I said in that conversation, I was like, "But the one I would really love to do is I'm a Celeb." Like, that's always been my thing. At the end of every year, it just fills me with so much joy to watch it. And literally, as we were filming, an hour later, like this production, that didn't go anywhere. But an hour later, my manager phoned and I had a missed call. So I thought I'd just phone her on the way back. But weird, she knows I'm filming. I don't know why she's calling me. And then she phoned me. She was like, "I'm a Celeb. I've asked you to come in for a meeting."
Mm.
I was like, "No, shut up." She was like, "Yeah." She was like, "It's filming in Wales this year rather than Australia." And I was like, "Okay." And then there was a whole thing of, I always said that whenever I was asked, if I was ever asked, it would be a yes, a straightforward yes. But then actually the reality of, we're living in a pandemic, it's in Wales, which didn't bother me that at all. But the reality of leaving home for not only the time that you're in the castle, but for the isolation period beforehand.
So how long was it? A week before and after?
It was 2 weeks before and then 3 weeks actually in the castle.
Right.
So 5 weeks in total. So I managed to take the boys with me for some of it. Max was with me for most of the isolation period, which was lovely as well, because that, for me, I had time with them where I was cut off because management weren't getting in touch to ask me to do anything. You know, we weren't allowed to go anywhere out of our house. I mean, I know Vernon was caught going for a run and a couple of other people went for big walks, but I was such a goody two shoes. I literally just walked around the garden and I had my dad and my stepmom with me. And so they were going for like 5K runs around this garden. We made a path around it by the end of it. It was muddy and slushy.
So could you see the other celebs? Did you know who they were at that point?
No.
Oh, how weird.
So it started getting leaked. And again, I didn't contact any of them, even though they were being leaked, because you just don't want to be the one to get into trouble, because you don't know, you know, who's really in
the
producers. They
might throw you
off. Might say something.
Totally. And so, I think as for you as well, I think what came through watching it was, as a parent, I mean, I just think as a parent, of young children, it's 100 times harder. I'm just putting it out there, because you're not just missing your spouse or whoever it is that you've got at home. Your mind is going 19 to the dozen, I guess, thinking, is Buddy okay? Will they have found his socks? The amount of stuff you must have had in your head.
Well, what's interesting, so every year I go on a week trek for Copperfield.
Yeah, yeah.
And we go away and I've learnt sort of... I've learned that when I'm there, I compartmentalize. Even though those treks, I guess I'm there and I'm there for every single trekker. So I go in every single group. I go up and down the line. I talk to every single person. I find out why they're there. We have a cry, you know, invariably. And it's an absolutely amazing experience. But that I do feel, although it's great for me, there's always one moment that's for me, that's purely for me. And I can remember being in Oman and the trek had ended. We'd had a little dinner. It was nice. And then a few of the guides were having sort of a drink on the beach. And then someone just said, let's go into the sea. And I can remember going into the sea that night, just lying on my back and looking up at the stars and the moon and just being like, this moment, this one moment, this is mine.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely beautiful. And I feel like every trek I get one moment that's like that. But it's taught me to sort of compartmentalize in some way, because if I'm not at home, it's not worth me not being at home and just wishing I was at home all the time, or worrying or wondering what's going on. So I have learned to compartmentalize. And what I found I did in the castle as much as possible is I think of the boys first thing in the morning, because I was always up early. Me, Vic and Mo were always the first up. But I'd lie there in my hammock and I'd think of the boys there. You know, I would have a little cry, to be honest, in the mornings. I shed a little tear. And then when I got into bed in the evening, I would picture them, each of them, and I'd give them a little kiss and say goodnight to each of them before I closed my eyes. And I just felt like, although I could talk about them absolutely fine the majority of the time, I felt like I wanted to make the most of the experience and make them proud. And also I'd shown them a clip of last year's before going in. And they loved it at first. And then when the task started, highlight reel, and all the screaming started, Buzz started crying because he was like, I don't want you to do it. I don't want you to go there and be scared. Aww. And I was like, Buzz, I promise you, I'm going to go and I'm going to have the best time ever. Yeah. And that, for me, knowing that my kids were watching, I wanted to make them proud and to see their mum just taking on these things and doing it with a smile, with determination. So for me, I think I always had them in the back of my head. And there were moments, obviously, where things happened and you feel like you're going to be okay. Because I think being a fan of the show, I'm aware that it's a TV show. I'm aware that these things happen and it's okay. It's okay. Like when I didn't get my thing from home, I just kept saying to everyone, it's okay. Guys,
oh, no,
it's
it wasn't okay for us, actually, at home. No one was okay.
But I said
moment.
To myself before the thing actually even happened, and I don't know why, but I said to myself before we started, you're not getting it. Something about it just told me I'm not getting it.
Yeah.
And I could just feel it building up in me. And I just wanted to say to everyone, look, it's so important that you enjoy this. It's your moments from her. And it's so important that you enjoy it, because we've all worked hard. We've all been here a long time and we all want those little words. And this is fine. Like, I know I'm crying.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, but
because
honestly,
I'd be crying
to enjoy it
with them for their moment. So for anyone listening who didn't see that moment, it was when the moment the people in camp get a letter from home, and G didn't get her letter from home, and everyone at home, literally at home, was like, oh my gosh, and everyone in camp was like, oh my gosh, and you actually did seem the finest out of anybody. I mean, with the thing of the children and the screaming, did you find that when you were doing the challenges, were you super mindful of, okay, this is horrendous, but I need to be cool because the kids are watching? Like, that would be really hard.
I think I'm also someone though that goes in and goes, I want to get the job done.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I think I can focus. So there are certain things that we did, but there were loads of bugs and stuff, and I did not see them. I did not see the bugs because I was focused on the task at hand.
Yeah.
And just doing that. So I do think it's a focus thing. Plus, It's fun, you know, in this fun weird way. Kind of in my head went, I'm never going to be experiencing this again in my life.
And ultimately, you know, they're not going to ask you to do something that's going to kill you.
Nothing's like, going to hurt
it's gonna
me,
be safe.
Really.
Yeah.
Exactly. This is the safest way ever to have loads of bugs put on me or, you know, so I did kind of feel like just embrace it. And I think if you're doing something like that, you do.
Yeah. I think what I loved about this year, and it actually happened last year, because earlier series of I'm a Celebrity, I actually ended up switching off because I can't bear confrontation. And it did feel like the team were putting together characters who were going to flare up at each other. Mm. And that just made for uncomfortable viewing. And obviously it made great on the viewing figures. But what I've loved about the last couple of years is there's been two solid years of the most beautiful vibe in the camp.
Yeah.
And for people to realize that kindness and goodness is amazing to watch. Yeah. I think that's so powerful and quite exciting going forward. Like that's not meant to sound really heavy, but do you know what I mean?
No, I completely agree. And it was said to me before going in, you know, we're not looking for drama. And I imagine some years it's really hard because you put people in and you think, you know, you don't really know how people are going to deal with hunger.
No.
Or how they're going
to,
you know, not sleeping or all these. You don't know how people are going to cope with those things. You can't prepare for that. You know, you can have the psych test and all of that, but you don't know until you're in it.
Yeah.
You know, we can all say, oh, I'm going to be fine. But until you're there.
What was the new thing that you learned about yourself in the camp? Was there something new that you learned that you hadn't realized before?
Oh, that I am just terrible at just sitting and doing nothing. I'm terrible at it. You know, the first few days I was running around like a blue ass fly. I felt like a Julie Walters kind of sketch character at one point. I caught myself, you know, when you come back, suddenly that third eye thing. And I just thought, what are you doing? Like, you're acting like the scullery maid. Stop. Enjoy
Stop
it. Because you're so used to mothering everyone and doing all these things. And, you know, you're doing a bit of the wood chopping and then you're cooking and then you're doing, you know, you're just doing everything. And then we were given our individual tasks. So I got cooking with Mo, which was fun, like, great fun.
Yeah.
And then after that, I got, I was made camp leader, which meant I could do nothing. And for the first time, it meant I could just sit and enjoy. I could literally just sit and have chats.
Yeah.
And kind of realize that so often in my life, I think this is my biggest takeaway. I feel like I'm in a moment. I feel like I'm experiencing it. I feel like I'm having fun with the kids, but actually I'm on the periphery. They are having fun and I'm doing the washing up or I'm clearing up or I'm, you know, there's so many things that, you know, you feel like because the laughter is going into your ears that you are there, but you're not.
Yeah.
So for me, my biggest takeaway is to stop doing that and to place yourself in the action rather than on the periphery.
I love that. And I think it's also the way that so many of us mums are very rarely in the photos.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm always the one taking the photos. I guess it depends what people's other halves are like. But, you know, I'm so relate to what you just said, because, you know, so often it is that I'm the doing and it's all going on over there and you think you're in the thing. So one of the things I was going to ask you, and this feels like a natural time, are the five habits that you use in life to thrive. And so I suppose making sure you're in the moment, would that be very much one of them?
Absolutely. That's definitely one of them, because I just think otherwise life passes you by and then what's it all for?
Do you have any ways of making yourself stay super present?
I do a few things. Compartmentalizing is definitely one. Like, I don't think I could do the treks or anything like that unless I did. That also includes in terms of work now, rather than fretting over something that's coming up, you know, in a week's time or a month's time. I try not to say the night before because, you know, some things need planning.
Yeah.
But until you need to get to that planning point, there's no point fretting about it. So
yes.
I try to compartmentalize and not fret about things.
Yeah.
Also switching off for me, which I found with Sudoku, to the point where Tom went to bed the other night, because I'm very aware of how easy it is to scroll on your phone and to just mindlessly do things. So Tom got into bed the other night and he was like, oh, what are you doing? And I was like, Sudoku. He was like, I did not expect that. But I just love it. So right now, rather than filling my head with other noise, I do that instead, which
that must
weirdly
be amazing for your sleep as well, because you're not looking at a screen before bed.
Well, yeah. And I have this little book that so we were asked before going into the castle what we would like in the house when we were in isolation.
Yeah.
And I got sort of the old Netflix and things like that. I was like, can I also have a colouring in book and a Sudoku book? I'm like, okay. Either everyone else, like someone had a running machine, weights.
Oh,
all
that's
sorts.
Genius.
Yeah, if I had Sudoku. And it is that thing where you have to almost relax with it though, weirdly, because otherwise it feel like again you can find that fast pace. I'm going to do it fast and whatever. But that really relaxes me. Strangely,
oh, I love that. So that's a genius idea. Okay, so we've got compartmentalizing, switching off. What would another one be?
Saying no, which I...
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, which I didn't think I could ever do. I'm such a people pleaser. You know, I said I was a teacher's pet and that has run through life. Like, I've always wanted to do everything to please everyone. But now I have started saying no a lot more and thinking about what the knock-on effect of that is. And, you know, talking in terms of, like, your own projects and stuff as well and kind of going... Yeah. Well, you know, it's so easy to just keep saying yes, but actually where does that break? You know, and I know this is called limitless, and I think you can only, you know, limitless is something that you have to take ownership of and you have to
totally,
take charge
but
of.
Saying no is part of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because otherwise you're using up your fuel on someone else's thing.
Yes.
Where you've got your own thing that you should be focusing
on. Yeah. It's about using your fuel on your own limitless potential in life.
Yes.
And actually saying no is a massive part of that. And we don't, and so many women in particular are people pleasers and are the perfectionists. And so do you have any kind of mantra or method by which you say no? So I love the phrase, it's either a hell yes or it's a no. Like I know for myself,
I like that.
If an invitation even comes in to go out for an evening, if I know the day's going to come and I'm going to go, oh, why did I say yes to that? I say no from the get-go.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah. I don't actually. I think lots of things depend on how I feel at the time that something comes in or something I get an ask. But I always feel like if I say no and then I feel relieved, it was the right decision.
Yeah.
But yeah, otherwise you just fill your head with so many other things. And I think it all gets a bit messy, to be honest.
Yeah, totally. I love that. Saying no. Okay. And earlier you talked a lot about walking and going outdoors.
Yes.
So I'm guessing that's a massive thing for you.
Massive one for me. It's huge. I mean, what's difficult with walking, I feel, is that it takes time. And if you've got a busy workload, you're kind of like, well, if I want to go out for an hour walk, then that's an hour that I could be writing. But it's that catch-22, isn't it? Because if you go out for an hour's walking, you're going to be more productive when you get back because you're going to have thought through things and you're going to be able to go straight in there and you're just going to be in a better headspace having been away from the house. Because
totally.
Working from home as well, I think it is that thing where you have to remember to leave. I can remember when Tom was on tour once and he was away. I think he was out of the country completely. And I was writing and I went to put the bins out one day and the chain was still across the front door. And I realized that I hadn't left the house in 5 days. So I'd just been at my home, I'd been at home on my own, not seen anyone. And it just, you realize very quickly, I think, how it can bog you down, not getting out and seeing the world.
And you can actually get to the point, and I'm getting this with a lot of clients at the moment and friends and family, that actually this season that we've been through when we've all been shut at home, now that the world is normalizing in inverted commas, there's a lot of anxiety around that because there's such familiarity with being in your own four walls with the chain across. You know, it's kind of so cozy, isn't it? And it's like...
Yeah.
Relearning how you get dressed, how you put your makeup on, like, how do I do this? I have no idea
what to wear. Like, I've got no idea.
Oh, and I have no interest in fashion either. It's so weird. I used to love it, and now I'm like, I don't need it. Like, I think we've managed so much this last year, haven't we, without all the stuff, and it's like, it's okay. And finally, your number five.
To remember to bring the laughter in, I would say.
Oh, I love that.
Because I think it's that whole thing of remembering what you're doing things for. We can all get so bogged down with all the different things and the juggle. But to remember why you're doing it. And and that life's fun. You're meant to be having fun.
Yeah.
I think I can be a little stress head at times. And being aware of it and kind of stopping is the best thing.
How do you manage with, I know at the beginning we were talking about all the hats you have, you know, podcaster, writer, author, actor, all of the stuff, author and writer. I gave you both titles there. How do you manage to be in the moment when you are switching from writing to being with the kids? When I was a kid, there was this amazing program on telly called Wurzel Gummidge. And Wurzel was this scarecrow who had different heads depending what he was doing. He would, horrendous looking back, physically take his head off. And I sometimes feel like that as a mum, as someone working, as a podcaster, when you're changing the heads all the time, how do you be in the moment that you're in?
I find that my easiest switch is from writing to home life. I find that that's the easiest. And podcast, I'd say when I'm going out, like I did a little stint on Virgin, or, you know,
yes, I
filming
saw
different things. I feel like that's the biggest gear change, because you're somewhere where people listen to you and it's an amazing respect going on. And then you get home and you're just like, oh, same, you know, no one's listening to me. It's difficult. I find that the biggest shift, that gear change of just where you sit within the family, I guess. Whereas writing for me that I do at home, it's been hard this last year with writing because the kids have been here. So for you know, a huge part, I've had to kind of do it when I can and then kind of push a book back. So that's why this book is this year rather than last year.
I love that you put a book, pushed the book back, by the way.
I had to.
It's so easy to keep on the treadmill of other people's agendas. And the moment you go, the world is going to still keep turning if this deadline gets moved.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
And understanding, you know, we're living in a global pandemic, like, you know, it's a book, to put it into perspective. And I've got such an amazing agent and an amazing editor, and they both just got it straight away. They're mums, they're homeschooling, you know, they understood it completely. They've been very relaxed about it, to be honest, which is pretty incredible. But I got to a point, I think the first lockdown, we had the Easter holidays and I was writing and I was being productive, not as productive as normal, but getting stuff done. And I thought, this is fine, I can do it. It's going to take a little bit longer, but I can do it. And then going back into homeschooling and trying to have Buzz in my office and getting that done and just being like, actually, there's just no way. I can't get my head in these characters. There's also a global pandemic going on and I'm worried constantly about the news and about what's going to happen to us, to our families. There's so much uncertainty, and I'm meant to be writing a book about hope, you know. And I know I write what I need, but at the same time, you kind of have to listen to your head and your heart a little bit as well. Totally. So they were absolutely incredible with
and talking pause. About listening to your head and your heart, I know you've touched on it throughout this chat, but Copperfield, how has that partnership, how did that come about? And tell everyone what Copperfield is if they don't know.
Yeah, so Copperfield are a breast cancer awareness charity founded by Chris, who at 23, she had a few different symptoms and went to her GP, and they said it was nothing, it was just hormonal and not to worry about it. In fact, she was 22 the first time she went to visit the doctor, went away to India, came back, still experiencing pain. I think she might have had discharge at this point. And her mum was like, well, no, we're going back. The next GP said, no, I agree with the first, I wouldn't worry. Then her mum sent her back, went with her. I was like, I demand that she get seen by a specialist. She was then told that she had secondary breast cancer. And secondary stage 4 breast cancer, which had it been caught sooner, that wouldn't have been the case.
And she's got a twin sister, right?
She's got a twin sister as well. Yeah. And from that point on, you know, I think her charity status came in the same day that she had a mastectomy. And she just has made it her mission with Copperfield to spread that boob message. You know, we should all be checking from a young age. I think growing up, I always thought that it was something that happened to elderly people and then it was a lump. And fair enough, the people that I know who have experienced it, an amazing lady called Molly, who I used to work with in a florist, she passed away in her 60s. My auntie Marilyn passed away 4 years ago. She was also in her late 60s. So that they are older, But there are so many people who it happens to younger. Yeah. And Chris being one of them. And the more you dive into it, the more you see that it is out there. It does happen. And that we should be checking our boobs from a young age and getting to know them, men and women as well, because 400 men a year are diagnosed in the UK with breast cancer.
That was amazing because of you, looked at the Copperfield website. So that's great. So now I've signed up for my reminders. I've signed up to get a sticker that's going inside my bathroom cabinet. And they were showing how to check your breasts. And there was a guy on there. And I was like, wow, I had no idea.
Yeah. And that's the thing. So, and I guess for all of us, it's signs and symptoms that are a little bit embarrassing. You know, we think we're looking for a lump, but it's so much more. You're looking for nipple discharge, inverted nipple, rashes, dimpling, puckering, any like swelling, pain, anything. And it goes into your armpit and up to your collarbone as well.
Yeah, so, the collarbone. That surprised me as well. I didn't know there.
No, yeah. So anything. That you, if you get to know your body from a young age and you check regularly, then you will know if something goes wrong. And it's feeling and it's also looking. So looking in the mirror, because then if you detect something that is slightly different and then go and see your GP, it's literally the difference between an early diagnosis and survival or something much more sinister. So that is the key message with Copperfield. And that is what Chris set up 11 years ago now, 12 years ago this year.
Wow.
It's incredible. And so every year I do treks for them. So since 2017, I've been doing treks.
So where are you going this year?
This year, well, actually, we're doing two this year. So the one that people can't sign up for, because the 2020 trek was meant to be in the Sahara Desert. We're now going to Cornwall, because obviously we couldn't go to Sahara Desert. Yeah. But the one that people can sign up for still is the Scottish Highlands. And we just announced it today. Emma Willis is joining us as one of our captains. So that'll be incredible. And we'll have more guests invited being announced soon. But it's the 12th to the 18th of September. Scottish Highlands, 100 kilometres. It's going to be beautiful. It's going to be grueling. But honestly, these treks are the most life-affirming thing ever. There's something so therapeutic about putting one foot in front of the other. Your mouth and your brain, they suddenly loosen. Yeah. And these words and these thoughts come spilling out. And it's so healing in a way that you didn't even know that you needed.
Oh, I love that. That's amazing. So where should anyone go if they want to find details about that trek?
Head to my Instagram page or to the Copperfield website. So
copperfield.org. At
Mrs. G. Fletcher on Instagram.
Amazing. Okay, and finally, before I lose you, because this has been lovely, but I know you're a very busy girl. The rest of 2021. So we've got your book, Walking on Sunshine, coming out later in the year. What else is happening for you? The trek?
The trek, two treks because of Cornwall as well, and podcasts, still pushing through with those. And I think...
What was the season of podcasts you just finished? Was it season
just six? Finished season seven.
Finished
seven. So we're now about to start recording eight.
And you obviously had a massive interview at one point with the lovely Duchess, which must have been incredible. Who's on your list for the next series? Was she? I mean, I imagine she's everything I would want her to be.
She and more. I think with her as well, watching her on a royal engagement, talking to everyone, just her listening, you know, she asks a question and she listens to the answer and she asks another. Like, it's that simple thing of listening and responding, and you feel like she really cares. I was very nervous sitting down for that one.
Wow.
She was amazing.
She's amazing. And I think listening is such a massive thing that only when I did my coaching did I learn there's several different types of listening. Most of us listen at level one, which is literally ask a question, don't really want the answer. And then there's like level three listening, which is like you do on a first date, you know, when you're absorbed in each other and there's nobody else around and you're picking up on every vibe, every feeling you get from the person, as well as the words that are coming out of their mouth. That's level three, and that's what we don't generally do. It's amazing. You know, when you pick up something off a friend and it's your intuition, it's that's level three listening, which we do with people who are really close. And finally, what I ask every guest on this podcast, what would limitless living be for you? What does it mean for you, the word limitless?
Limitless means chasing after things, working hard, going for your goals, and doing so while enjoying life. So, you know, not letting those goals overtake, but letting them drive you, and enjoying what you already have and being grateful for what you already have, and at the same time saying no.
Yes. Oh my word. And honestly, when I introduced you as being one of the most authentic people that I see around, I genuinely meant that. And for me, Limitless is about living your authentic truth and your authentic life, which you are absolutely doing in Bucket Loads, if we've heard this past hour. Gee, it has been
Thank
so
you.
Gorgeous chatting to you.
Thank
honestly.
You and you.
I am so excited to be on this podcast journey with you. Please be sure to subscribe and rate the podcast and share with anyone in your crew you think would love it. Thank you so much for joining the journey. For more on my story, you can follow me on social media at I'm Katie Hill. And to be the first in line for all the latest Limitless news, head to katiehill.com and hit subscribe. Limitless, the life you were born to live.